welcome to the Tortoise Shack Live Housing Can We Build Back Better special. My name is Tony Groves, and I am delighted to be joined by CEO of Cooperative Housing Construction Tyro, Hugh Brennan. Hugh, how are you keeping?
Very well, thanks, Tony, and thanks again for the invite.
Not at all. It's great to see you. It's been a while. Our friend of the pod and lecturer in UCD, Orla Hegarty, is here. Orla, how are you keeping?
Fine, thanks. Token woman on the panel,
I assume. Yeah. No, I'm looking into the audience. Well, and can someone put their phone on silent? You know,
that's it's me, Sarah.
And architect, and as I said, Ireland's best looking man, Mel Reynolds, is here.
Hey,
Mel.
Hey, Greasy, how are you?
Hiya, Mel.
It's good to be joined by old friends, Mel. Good to thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Listen, the reason we wanted to do this is because the budget is in the books, and even a few minutes ago the housing minister stood up and said the words were, drop your ideology, forget your ideology. And when I read the budget, and this is a question, I suppose, straight to I'm going to start with you, Orla, if you don't mind. The housing model, delivery model that they're still putting in this budget seems very much the same model that we had previously, the same expensive €470,000 per unit, rather than something that actually is genuinely affordable.
Yeah, well, I suppose, I mean, two signals that sound positive, but we haven't seen them playing out. One is more money for direct build social housing, which can only be a good thing because it's a more efficient use of limited money and will support efficiency like Hugh is delivering. And the second one that's positive is more money going into housing, which is probably a good thing. On the downside, more money seems to be going into subsidies, you know, as well, rather than reform. So we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But you're right. I mean, the all signals are that the same model will continue. And if you look at the NAMA deal on the Poolbeg site yesterday down in Ringsend, you know, it's remarkably similar to the O'Devany site in a lot of ways. In it, it's the same idea that you sort of hand over the land and you hand over control of whether it will be delivered and what the houses will cost. And you lose control of that for a little bit back, which isn't a lot really in the overall scheme of things.
You've just said what I dread most. And I suppose I'll go to Mel on this. Mel, the O'Devany deal. When we were talking about this it seems pre-pandemic in a different world, in a different time, we were talking about how this was basically money for old rope for Bartramore doing really well on the deal. Do you want to just give us a quick refresher on the O'Devany deal, if you don't mind?
You're catching me on the hop here. It wasn't so much that Bartramore were getting a great deal. I suppose they were, because they were paying, I think from memory, they were paying about €2 million up front. Mm-hmm. And getting the use of the lands for a certain period of time. Basically, from memory, they were getting about half the site for free. And the remaining half, the costs and the values of the units that were being bought back, in particular the affordable ones, hadn't been really drilled into. So, you know, the whether there's a margin there or not, I think given the fact that the sort of yield back to the state is so poor from it, you'd have to wonder why the local authority isn't sort of doing the same thing. If there's a master plan in place, which has been done by DCC, why don't they just hive the site up into smaller packages and issue licensing agreements to builders to build it direct and be the developer themselves? Because it seems that using the developer model, in fairness to Bartra, they are probably doing what all the other tenderers are doing. They were probably the most cost beneficial scheme than anyone else. They're just trying to extract a profit. So basically, the site value is being eaten up by a developer's profit and also by high financing costs. And we know the state at the moment, I think the cost for the state to borrow €5 billion is somewhere in the region of €50 million a year. So, I mean, why the state isn't actually doing this and starting a revolving fund, entering into licensing agreements with entities like Hughes company there, to build out at significantly lower discounts. I just don't understand it.
Orla, this comes back to what you said about a flotilla of solutions. Instead of having one large developer come in and dictate the site, you could have several smaller developers come in, and that leaves you, first of all, less exposed if something goes wrong. And we have seen that on public-private partnerships where things have gone wrong, and it is us that ends paying up for them. And if you couple that with what Locke and Sir were saying, where you bring in Hugh and you just say to Hugh, how do you scale up? Mm. Why aren't they doing it?
I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's not a case that some large entity comes in with an army of staff from somewhere on a bus or a fleet of buses in the morning. You know, any of these large entities that get these contracts are going to employ the same people. So there are only the native Irish builders as subcontractors and sub-subcontractors and tradespeople and suppliers. So they will be at the bottom of the chain in any case. And how you set it up is about how many middlemen are in the deal getting a slice, or how many overseas investors are getting good returns on an investment with a high percentage or whatever. But it's the same people. And the problem with setting up these really big deals is those people are at the bottom of the chain, getting poor employment conditions, lack of apprentices, as you've talked about before, bogus self-employment, sub-subcontracting. Very hard to get people into the construction industry as future careers, very hard to get people skilled up in those terms. So what you've got is a lot of sandwich in the middle. Now, if you break it up, it might seem counterintuitive to people, but if you break it up, you have lots of opportunities for SME builders to get back on their feet. But you've also got all those people competing against each other. So if you break up that site into 10 smaller deals, whether it's you or whether it's somebody else who's, you know, stuck not getting land at the moment and is well able to build, you get competition between them in terms of good standards, in terms of good quality, a bit of you get diversity so that you don't have a street that's just all the same thing. You get a good mix of different styles, and people who want to buy have different things. But you get better employment terms too, because if somebody's not a good contractor to work for, people will go and work for the other guys, you know. So it's a way of weeding out the bad apples and weeding out poor standards and making sure that there are more money goes straight into employment on good terms at the bottom, rather than a lot of money being lost in the middle of the sandwich and the people at the end still on poor employment terms.
I'm going to go to you now, and it's a strange one, because it's only a few weeks ago we spoke to Ronan Lyons on the pod, and he sort of gave us the spiel about the cost of building has gone up by X and all of this, we can't afford to do that. And he actually, and when we went back and we talked about and suggested your model, he said, well, you just can't scale up something like that. And he did say that. So it's on the podcast, it's on the record. You, can you scale up the sort of stuff that you guys do?
Of course you can. And it seems to be that perception out there that you can't scale it, but you can. And effectively, you can look at us, Coolin as a developer. And it is, in a sense, a developer-led model. We've said this before. You know, people call us those social developers or soft developers or whatever you want, but it is still a developer-led model. So it's not that it can't be scaled. It's that there's something else in there. There's some other reason why it isn't being scaled, or why it won't be scaled. In the budget, they've allocated 110 million for affordable purchase. Okay, now in the budget it says that's going to go for the shared equity scheme. Okay, and the likelihood is, I think, that if it does go, that the number of houses that would build, I think, is somewhere in the region of 700 and probably even less. And the way it will work, I think, is that if you're going out looking for your house, you can go down to the spec houses down the road, and the best value that you're going to get anywhere around the city, I think, would be around 400,000. And the local authority will take a maximum of 40% of that, or the state, or somebody, okay? And that's 160,000. And then you will put down the difference, which is what, 240,000. Okay, and you'll get your mortgage on 240,000. And that's not bad. That's not a bad place to start off at all, and you'll be paying something around 1,200 a month. But where does that other 160,000, where does that magically come from and go to? where that comes from is it comes from you. Eventually you're going to have to pay that back. And where does it go to? It goes to a private developer. And what's the council or the state doing in the middle? They're actually loaning it to the or loaning it to you so it can be given to the developer. So for me, that isn't a great way to scale affordable housing for purchase.
It's a redefinition of what a. Sorry, I'm getting a bit of feedback.
You're back.
On my
You're
mic.
Okay. You're
yeah,
fine.
No, that's, it's a redefinition of what affordable is, though, isn't it? Really, like
it's effectively a subsidy scheme. It's not really affordable. I mean, it might seem marginally affordable to the person who's getting the mortgage, but it's not affordable to the taxpayer. You know, there was a great quote in the Guardian today about these kind of housing policies that give a little bit of help to a small group to get them over the line, but in a way that inflates the prices for everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, and that's true. It's just marginally increasing the market.
And we like to do positive. So that's a really good positive view to start with, that yes, this can be scaled up. There is no obstacle to bringing in developers like you, Hugh, and actually scaling up. And I want that to be really clear. So let's put that to bed. That's a positive we can do. Orla, can we get, actually Mel, I'll ask on this one. Can we get the finances together to do this?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, look, how do you scale up a way of doing business? It's very easy to set this out. I mean, I suppose Orla, her specialization is in procurement. So if you want to, you know, if you want to do brain surgery, go to a brain surgeon. It looks very difficult to the rest of us, but to somebody who has the qualification and the expertise, it's a piece of cake to do it every day. So if you want to know about a procurement, Orla is the person to talk to, or an architect who's been in the business for 30, 40 years, whatever. You know, issuing a license, basically the state owns an abundance of land, something like 50% of zoned residential vacant land in County Dublin is controlled by the state. It's either still owned by NAMA or owned by the four Dublin local authorities. That figure is nearly 70% in Dublin City, which is remarkable. If you think about 3 out of every 4 vacant sites that you walk by is either controlled by NAMA with their debtors or it's owned by Dublin City Council. Dublin City Council on their own 112 hectares of zoned residential land, which is enough for between 15 and 18,000 dwellings at higher densities. So they've an enormous amount of land. The levels of debt on the state-owned land are very low. It's somewhere in the region of, I think Michelle Norris mentioned somewhere in the region of about 400, 450 million. So it's an average of maybe 10,000 euros per site. So it's negligible. When you're, if you're to turn around and enter into a license agreement, you write a letter of agreement with a developer or with a builder like you. So you can control the sales price, which is based on cost. You can control the margin there. So it doesn't have to be 20% or 15%. It can be 5%. And also you control the land value, which is the critical point of this. So, you know, the sort of savings that the SCSI, the Society Chartered Surveyors, mentioned in the recent revised cost report of between 140 to 160,000 euros per dwelling are purely on the basis of doing building this way. So it doesn't mean you have to employ anyone. It doesn't mean you might need a bit of expertise drafting your standard template. But if you turned around and said to each local authority, I want 300 licensed affordable units based on your tender prices from 2019, you'd be seeing, you know, 2-bed apartments. I just looked it up here. The average all-in cost for Dunleary Rathdown County Council, which is probably the most expensive place to build at the moment, in 2019 was 294,000 euros. That includes the site, VAT, professional fees, you know, unusual site conditions, everything, all in. The actual hard building cost there was 226,000. So that's way removed from the sort of prices you see for Part 5s of 450, 500 and more thousand euros that you see.
The average of 470 on Part 5 at the moment, I think.
Yes, 470. So, I mean, the developer-led model works very well at certain ends of the spectrum. We know that land prices have been persistently high. we know that financing costs are high and it's a high risk business. So if you're going to develop, there needs to be a margin there for you to do it. But the difficulty is that right at the end of the, we haven't, in the last 20 years, wages have gone up by about 1% a year. And we're now, the ironic thing is we're now in a situation where the fiscal policy coming down from the EU, particularly accentuated by the pandemic, is giving us these ultra low interest rates, which means that asset prices are not going to fall. It's all about maintaining jobs, maintaining share prices. And the unintended consequence of this is you're going to have these persistently high costs for assets like housing. So you're probably going to see very little fall in housing prices. You might see a blip. But as long as we have these really low rates, because the correlation between mortgage rates and prices is somewhere in the region of about 0.92 or 0.94 over 40 years. So it's a really strong correlation in it. So the only way, if you're going to subsidize affordable housing to 100,000 euros a unit, that means everyone has been given the same incentive. It's a demand side incentive. So prices are going to go up. So the only way you can do it is control the process from the very start. You have the site, you design it. I mean, a planning permission, a part eight on a site can be done in about 16 weeks with a local authority. You can come across and work. You have your costs from all the other stuff you're building. There's tender prices for 1, 2, 3, and 4 bed houses and apartments all over the country. And you can just enter into negotiations and go off to various different suppliers. As Orla said frequently, do group bargaining and have a panel of suppliers as well for windows, doors, blocks, timber frame, you name it. And you've got standard designs and away you go, the way it was done for years. So the thing about it is, in terms of scaling up, a process or a way of doing business can be scaled up incredibly quickly. It's just a mindset. It's almost like, how do you scale up an idea? How do you scale up a concept? It's there. All you have to do is just get familiar with it and get moving on it.
It's also not a reinvention. What she's doing is what was always done in the past. It's not. There's no new invention to a lot of ways,
Tony, right. Just going to ask you, Hugh has explained he can do it. Mel has explained how the process of getting it done. Where we are in the pandemic, Tony, and with finance the way it is coming from the ECB, will you explain how it's actually cheaper to do this than what we're doing?
Oh, well, you don't need me to explain that. You've just seen the government's own, the Irish government's economic evaluation service said it was cheaper for us to do it that way. They said they could do it themselves for half of what we're paying in the private markets. Even Ronan Lyons said as much as well. He said we need a mix, but he's talking about, bringing it from 10% to maybe 20% to maybe to and we find where the floor is. So there's a place for that as well. But I suppose what we're worried about on the wider scheme of things is, Mel has pointed out, the volume of land that we have that's currently under state control. And I mean, I see the concerns actually in the comments section. People are saying it. Does that just mean that that's just more land that is going to be distributed a la the O'Devany type model, and we're going to see that more expensive delivered? Like I do recall one important thing on the O'Devany site, Mel, and it was quite humorous that they were to build a community centre was one of the deals to build a community centre, but they were getting reliefs to the same value as the community centre, so that they were in effect, it was a wash. They were getting out. And so if you were sitting down with Dublin City Council and you're saying, well, why are we doing this model? What is the, other than them not wanting to get into the business of building, what is the block there? Orla?
I think it's probably a mindset. I mean, we've had 10 years of recession where, local authorities and departments were probably lost a lot of their technical skill and experience of doing stuff. And there's a sort of an outsourcing mindset in government, which is that the private sector market will meet. And I suppose they've also been fed a lot of sort of disinformation about the market and how it works, and things that, like, supply will reduce the cost of housing, when it's demonstrably the case that it's not, because once people buy land at a high price with the intention of selling houses at a high price, the price is baked in. And if they can't get that price, they stop building. They don't build cheaper and reduce the price of housing. So it's much more complex and sophisticated, the supply and demand curve in housing and land, than it is in other sectors. So there's a sort of simplistic idea that if we built loads of houses, they'd all be really cheap. I think there's also a lack of understanding about how it all works, because on some level, maybe people are thinking it's like the children's hospital. You need 2 billion to do a housing program in Ireland, whereas housing is incremental. It's a bit at a time, and you move in. So, like, if you give 100 small builders 1 million each to get them started, and they build 4 or 5 houses with that, well, they can then sell them or rent them, and that 1 million is recouped to do the next stage. So, you know, that small scale model actually gets stuff happening really, really fast. I mean, you know, if Hugh can build a terrace of houses and he can sell the first 8, he then has capital for the next 8 or 12 or whatever. So you don't need to say, I'm giving somebody 100 million or 200 million for this site and we need to borrow it. You actually just need seed capital in housing, because it is small stages and small bites. And the quicker you can turn around phases and move people in, they might have a mortgage for 240 grand, or they might be paying 1,000 a month in rent, or they might be on a subsidized rent of 600 a month. But it's turning the money straight away very quickly, within 6 or 9 months. So the idea of having to find billions and all this for a housing program it doesn't make any sense at all. It's much easier to fund housing than to build anything else.
Well, interesting enough, you probably have a comment on this, because you guys work on the basis of the people who are going to purchase, that, you know, they're going off to get the finance, and you're working on that model to scale it out. So do you want to just give a quick sort of walkthrough through this? I'd say you're blue in the face explaining it, but just how would the model actually operates?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, on the financing side, it's exactly the way Orla described it. I mean, we're looking at the moment at the possibility of setting up a little fund that would be just there for us, and we would recycle that. So precisely as Orla said, you build your first phase, you sell them, you've already started building your second phase, and you're reusing the money all the way through. Just to give you an example, in the first scheme, I think the contract value was about 6.2 million, and our peak borrowings were 1.8 million. So with 1.8 million, we were able to build out the 49 quite comfortably. In our second development, and this is interesting as well, we didn't actually go to the bank. we issue what we call loan notes. So that's to you, Tony. You're Bob in the bank. You can come and you can give us 100,000, and we keep it for 18 months or 3 years, depending on what you want. And we will use that as our construction finance. And we'll give it back to you, and we'll actually give you a return on it, a better return than you're going to get in the bank. We're prepared to give you 4% on it. And that's what we're giving to a charitable trust in Cork at the moment, who have loaned us 1 million euros, and we're using that to build the second development, along with other loan notes. So there are private individuals who have come to us and said, yes, we'd love to invest in what you are doing, and we do that, and we give them their 4%. But it's nowhere near the cost of the entire scheme. So you never really, or you should never really look at trying to have to fund the full scheme. I want to come back just to one point that Mel was making there. That was a really interesting figure of the 294,000 in Dunleary. I wasn't fully aware of that. It's really interesting. On that one, if you were to try to rent that out now, okay, that 294,000, and you'd be looking probably at a rent of, I'm guessing now here it is, but Mel can help me, but I'd say around 1,500 a month that the investor would need to get back and, you know, to set aside a few bob for, you know, maintenance and all of that kind of thing. That would be the market. We were doing some figures on this, and if we were to get 80% of the market rent, we can make that work as a cost rental scheme, okay? Using our costs, and that's assuming that you don't get any other subsidy. So take that 1,500 and multiply by 0.8. So that's 1,200, and that's not a bad rent for a two bedroom department, because a two bedroom department, you're assuming is a couple, and you've got two incomes, and a couple on around earning jointly around 50 to 55 thousand would be able to afford that based on paying no more than say 33% of their net income on their on their rent. You know, so the point I'm making is that even on the local authority's own figures, that it is actually possible to build for cost rental, because everybody's saying at the moment that it's not possible, you know, that the figures just don't stack up.
Mm.
And then if you do something like add in the site services fund into that, and the site services fund will be up to, say, 50,000 per unit, you'll get that rent right down to around 950, if my figures are right there. And that's really, really affordable. So that's somebody who is literally just earning above the threshold for social housing would be able to go in, or a couple would be able to go in, rent an apartment affordably based on local authorities' own figures.
No, that is really, really, really positive. If we could think in that fashion, unfortunately, when you refer to rental now, we see the big players tend to be the REITs now, and it's built to rent. And I know, like we've seen in certain areas in Dublin, they are the biggest players. Like there's a certain districts where they account for nearly 40% of beds, as they say, you know, and that is when you're up against them, they pretty much set the rents then at that. And we're stuck into that model. Is there a reason, Mel, that, I mean, and again, I'm going back to, like other people argue, but at least the REITs are creating capacity in the system. And that means that there's other availability elsewhere. But is there not a reason for the state to get involved in, if a REIT can do it, why can't we do that? And you can rent for life.
Nothing at all. I suppose the difficulty with the REITs is that it's sort of a structure at the moment, which is a bit like a juggernaut. If you look at any of the detailed analyses of any of the rental REITs here, you can see that the structure that's in place is pretty big. It's well funded. We know that the REITs are at around 98% capacity at the moment, and just the funding model that's out there with the low interest means that you can quite easily carry a scheme that's 30 or 40% vacant and still make a 6 or 7% yield, gross yield. So the sort of numbers that Hugh was talking about there was, if you're looking at, say, 1,200 a month on a 300,000 build cost, that's 4.8% yield. So if you think the bottom line for REITs, because they can borrow at sub 2% on the market at the moment, you've got average rents around 15 to 1600 in Dublin, and some areas a lot higher. They're a recession proof model, which is very good. They're being sold as defensive stocks, which means they'll do very well even in a recession because you can turn around and buy assets cheaply. But it's a tough one to compete against. So, you know, in areas, they're not going to drop rents. They can handle vacancies quite well. And this is the difficulty we're seeing in other, we're just following the same trends you're seeing in, you know, London, close to us, San Francisco, New York, where you're seeing the continual building of high-end schemes that are aimed at higher-end rentals that are substantially vacant for prolonged periods. And because the balance sheet, it's a balance sheet mechanism is in play here, that allows these things to be built and to be kept vacant for a long time. So it's almost counterintuitive. I mean, Centrepoint is a great example of that, which is pretty well vacant for 20 years. It was built, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, tallest commercial building in London. And basically, it was used to prop up a balance sheet for 20 years because rents were increasing and it was more valuable for its potential rent over its carry cost. So, you know, there's a whole series. What we're seeing is sort of on the receiving end of this large-scale fiscal policy is we're seeing these really high rents, stubbornly high rents, and large, you know, oversupply in at the luxury end, and a complete lack of affordable housing. And there's a complete blind spot here. I mean, it's not possible to build affordable housing using a developer-led model unless you're getting massive subsidies. It just isn't there because land costs are so high and margins are, you need a decent margin, and also financing costs are high. So there's about 140,000 there before you start in between land, financing and margin, which is sort of 60% of your affordable cost gone before you even dig a trench, you know, so it's just not possible to do it.
You call it a blind spot, Mel, but I think we'd all agree that it's ideology. There is no real reason why we can't be doing this. It is simply ideology. But how do we get past this? Tony would say we need a constitutional right to housing. We need it in the constitution. I would say you just need a different administration. What are your feelings? We'll start with you, Orla. What are your feelings? How do we get around this impasse?
Well, if you like, it's been painted into a corner because if you think back 10 or 15 years, lots of people bought very expensive housing and then the banks crashed and they were all in negative equity and there was a hole in the banks. And there's been 10 years of policy to, rather than to deal with that dysfunction and its damage to society in terms of the amount of money people are paying and the trauma and stress and awful conditions it visited on people for all those years. Rather than dealing with that, I think the policy has been to reinflate prices back up so that it got those people out of negative equity. It got the banks into a different place. And the consequence of that policy is that it's totally unaffordable for everybody else. So the only way I think out of it is without crashing those people back into negative equity and crashing the banks, is to have an ownership model that isn't in direct competition, you know, so that there's a way of buying your house so that you can own your house, or you can be paying the rent or the AHB or the cooperative or whatever model of ownership is there. Because the ownership model doesn't really matter. You know, we get distracted with, affordable or rental or mortgage, but effectively they're all just ways of paying back what was spent on the house. So that doesn't really, in some ways it doesn't matter. You know, you need something flexible that so that some people are paying rent and some people are paying a mortgage and some people are subsidized. So the paying it back is the really key thing for the economy now. So how do you get people to pay back for their housing or pay most or all of their housing costs without bringing down the rest? And that's a way of, there has to be some way of owning your house differently or somebody owning it differently. Yep. So maybe the land is split out into a community land trust or there's a different leasing arrangement. So there's some technical solution there that means it's a different type of way of owning or renting.
We've seen that suggested, and we've actually, before he was housing minister, spoke to Dara O'Brien about that, the proposition of, you know, taking the state always having the ownership of the land, and that brings down the price of the property, and therefore you can still own your home. But if you ever sell it on, they can, you know, they own the land forever.
Yeah, you're only selling the house and not the site.
Exactly. Yeah. And it builds it. So there has to be all these ways of, there's other more imaginative ways, and other countries have cracked this. So if they've cracked it, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We just want to steal a decent wheel. Key to your area is actually the land as well. The reason you can do it so affordably is because of the land. That I'm right in saying that.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So we get the land at 1,000 euros a pop, whereas the value that we put on it when we calculate what we call our clawback, you know, to make sure that the house that somebody doesn't exploit the fact that they have an affordable house and sell it on. So we reevaluate the local authority of 30,000. For that, and we get it at 1,000. So that is a huge benefit to us. We also, in Dublin City Council, they're prepared to waive the development levies for us. That makes a big difference. That's around another 8,000. So that's huge as well. But then also then there is the lack of the developer's margin. And I kind of get a bit of a bee in my bonnet with this, because I say that you never know what the private developer's margin is. And you never know what the land has has cost, and there's, you know, lots of other bits and bobs. So if you adopt a model, it doesn't have to be us, but it's something similar to us, where again it is literally just a cost, you know. So you look at the cost of building, you arrange to get the land at a reduced price, and then you add on your 5% margin just to keep your head above water, then it can be done, and it can be done all day, every day. And you can keep the affordability in perpetuity by lots of different ways. As Orla said, like the Community Land Trust, there's various other cooperatives, there's different other kind of shared ownerships without having the local authority involved, where the actual co-op themselves can be the other part of that shared ownership. I just want to say to you, there's an interesting group out there, and Orla and Mel will know them, and you probably do as well. They're called SOA, Self-Organized Architects. They are organising some great work at the moment on community-led housing. and they're producing a lot of information on it. And I think by January, they're going to have finished a piece of research. And I would encourage you, everybody, to go onto their website, and when that comes out, to get it and to read it. And that will really give a boost, I hope, to, you know, this fight, if you like, to try to look at the way we do housing differently. You know, Mel is right. It can never, affordable or even social, I would say, should never be handed over to private developers. And it doesn't have to be. It can be done by organizations like ourselves, or it can be done by the local authority just becoming a developer. They don't have to go back in and get all of the building skills that they had before. You know, if they have good clerk of works and engineers and architects on board, they can do that. They can do it as developers, as Orla said already. And that is a huge boost to the building industry. That lifts the people that Orla spoke about at the start there, who are getting the minimum wages because they're always being kept at the bottom by the big conglomerates. Those fellas, so that, you know, they have real skills. They'll go out on their own, you know, and like we did, you know, years ago, and they'll start off and they'll become the small and medium builders. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want in a, you know, in an economy. And, you know, just assuming that the market is always right, for me, is just wrong.
Yeah, just can I just second what you were saying there about you never really know what the margin and the land costs. We never really know. I mean, and when the costs came out of the 370 plus to build a house in Dublin, and I said, well, council housing has been built an awful lot cheaper. A lot of people said, well, that's because it's, you know, subsidised land and they're getting cuts. In the same week that they came out with the breakdown of 370,000 in Dublin, there were houses for sale in Wexford and in Sligo and in Mayo for 200,000. By private developers. Now, they're not building them at 150 grand loss. You know, so if you can build a house in Wexford or in Sligo or in the Midlands for 200 or 250,000 and sell it with a profit, having paid for the land, it's about expectation in Dublin. It's about, you know, it's about an expectation that people will pay 370.
And can I ask, we spent just
one voice, please.
Sorry, Mel, go ahead.
No, far ahead.
We spent just shy of €1 billion on HAP last year. I think I'm right about that. How many social and affordable houses could have been built for the billion that we spent on HAP?
Well, I'll tell you the numbers now. That dovetails in with what I was just going to say. If you just stick with two-bed apartments, the minimum and maximum construction cost for two-bed apartment in Ireland, for the hard cost for building, which is what everyone's talking about, you know, the cost of building is so high, it was 158,200 was the lowest, and that was in Longford. And the highest construction cost for a two-bed apartment was in Dublin City Council, which is an outlier, and it was 287,000 euros. So the all-in cost in Longford is 204, and the all-in cost in Dublin City was 370. Now, you know, they're way shy of what the averages are in Dublin, you know. Mm. We're looking at, we're all singing from the same hymn sheet here. We need to have a contrarian in the middle.
I'm trying to channel my inner Ronan Lyons every now and then.
But just in terms of a reality check, if you want to look at supply and demand, if you look at the demand for, I would sort of bunch social and affordable housing almost into the one category, because there's a huge cohort of people that would absolutely love to buy their own house if it was affordable, and they're either on HAP because they can't afford the rents that are out there, or they're on the housing list because it's the only option open to them. And Hugh will know more, because he's encountered a lot more people on his own list for that. But around the country, in terms of the combined figure for housing and HAP, as of last year, it was 124,000 people. And in Dublin City, in Dublin, in the Four Dublin Local Authority, it was 39,000, over 39,000 people were either on HAP, they needed assistance for rental, or they're on the housing list. Now, once you go on the HAP list, you lose your slot, except in South Dublin County Council. Now, the reason why it's so dysfunctional, if you look at the output, I always think the output in local authorities is a really good one to look at, because a local authority own land, historically they've owned land for years. They have the ability to get planning permission really quickly. They have government funding, so there's no problem in getting funding. And if we look at the output last year, now, the extraordinary thing after the budget, I steered away from everything to do with housing for a while, and I made the mistake of looking at some of the government interviews after the budget. And it looked a little bit like the invasion of the body snatchers, because it was like Simon Coveney with a different head saying the same numbers. But if, when you drill into the figures and you see in particular what's happening in Dublin County and the four Dublin local authorities, the area where you have a combined demand figure of almost 40,000 for social and affordable housing last year, the total figure for local authority building was 228 dwellings.
228 houses.
In the four Dublin local authorities. The figure for Dunleary was 17, as the highest prices in the country. Fingal was 54. South Dublin was 112. And Dublin City was 45. Now, the extraordinary thing about the Dublin City figure was, out of those 45 units, 24 Priory Hall refurbs were considered, were included in that figure. So, you know, that output figure for 2019 is less than what was built in 2017, 2 years after, along with Rebuilding Ireland. So the total for Dublin County, the four Dublin local authorities for bills, was 232. So in actual fact, we're seeing a persistent, ultra-low level of actual building of social housing. And we know that we have a massive demand on the other side. So the land capacity in Dublin County is the guts of 40,000. So we know that we have the land at the moment, Tier 1 zoned land. Fingal County Council and South Dublin, between them, own 67 square kilometres of land of all types, right? So that's, you know, a lot of that's amenity land, you know, shouldn't be zoned. But like Cherrywood is 700 acres. So a really small part of it you could designate as a new town. Like 67 square kilometres, to put it in context, is bigger than the country of San Marino. Like San Marino is 65 square kilometres. So the two Dublin local authorities own more, as much land as a small European country. And yet we're seeing between those two local authorities and the two other ones, like less than 250 homes being built. So there is a real problem here in terms of the system, the way that we're procuring things. Like the four-stage procurement system doesn't work for approved housing bodies, and it doesn't work for local authorities, and it's a real issue. The number of houses that were purchased, turnkey units purchased last year, was close to 4,500 units, new homes. So a lot, there's an awful lot of smoke and mirrors about the numbers here.
And that has been the trend for a number of years now. And it's great that you pointed out again, whereby we see this figure for bills, and you understand that they're purchased, they're long-term lease. Martin mentioned HAP. They have enhanced HAP. You know, we give you this enhanced leasing, and then we call that a new build. I'm conscious of time, and I'm conscious that people want to actually contribute a little bit. So I'm going to actually just go through a few comments here, and maybe if that's okay, I'm going to open a couple of mics if you guys are okay. Claire, you're one of the first people through. Do you want to ask your question, or?
This is usually the part where I keep people entertained.
Can you hear me, Tony?
Yeah, we can hear you. Yeah.
The kids are running around me here in the background. I'm basically just wondering if it was kind of actually answered throughout the webinar, and it was about how, like, why would DCC would do this? It makes no sense to me. It just seems so counterproductive and so against all the best evidence from, you know, the best people out there. I just can't understand why we're still doing. But I suppose you could say that across a lot of departments in the state. I think Orla actually answered it earlier on, though, when she said, you know, it's kind of been done this way. There's a mindset that's been there for a long time.
I just find...
I'm going to mute this because...
Yeah, no, please. No, that's... Look, no. Oh, thanks, Claire.
And thanks this...
I'm after muting you.
No, just thanks for... it was brilliant. You know, great to hear all the different perspectives.
Possible. I think that's really important to keep saying that. Like, these are all things that could be fixed pretty quickly, you know? Like, we need to keep positive about this. They're not the biggest barriers, actually. They're, you know, we have people now. We don't have the skills shortage. We have money. We have land. All the ingredients are there. It just needs someone to press the button.
Actually, Mel, you, we're seeing that one of the big one of the big asks of the state at the moment is retrofitting. You've got the most famous passive house in the country now, and it says, you know, it costs about €12 a year in electricity bills or something. How attainable is passive standard for new builds and then in the retrofitting thing? I know it's a big question, but just in terms of that, I think it's important that we understand that there's also a climate emergency, and this is part of the process.
Well, I suppose the eyes were open. I've been watching this for a good few years, and the eyes were opened for me in 2016 when there was a scheme called Madeira Oaks down in Wexford was launched by Michael Bennett Builders. And the second phase in that scheme was, the first phase was built to A3 standard, and he experimented and built the second phase of three beds there to the passive standard. And they went on for sale for €172,000. And pretty soon, because the demand, the price went up to 192. He added 20,000 onto for phase three. But he gave a great lecture in Dunleary. I went to it. His QS stood up and went through the costs in detail. And the cost difference at that stage between building, because he'd built effectively the same house to A rating versus a passive standard, was €4,000. That was it. And that was in 2016. So the regs have come up in the interim. And my experience is it's actually slightly cheaper to build to the passive standard, because if you're able to build to the A rating, just a few little tweaks, you can get to this particular standard. And it's all about the basis of it is effectively you don't need a primary heating system. You can forego your underfloor heating or RADs, which saves you about €15,000. So in a sort of 3-4 bed house, you're looking at maybe a €5,000 saving if you go to this a standard that's 40% better than A1. So there's no reason why it can't be done. Now, you do have to learn it. You have to learn how to do stuff a little bit better. There's a couple of tweaks to be done. But, you know, I had a learning curve. There's a number of people have been doing this for years and are far more experienced than me. This is my first time doing it. It was great fun. And we're doing another one, which is a retrofit to passive standard, and it's a walk in the park. So once you do it, it's a bit like riding in a limo. Once you do it once, you've done it a number of times. So the benefit of if you were to, say, twin this with, it doesn't have to be passive. It could be like the 15 kilowatts per square meter energy rating is the UN ultra low housing energy rating. It's coincidentally the same figure. So if you aim for this much more ambitious energy target, you know, you're going to see it's at least cost neutral, if not slightly cheaper. And if we did that on public housing, you could see that that's a way where the government could actually stimulate the learning and the training that needs to go in to get better at what we do. And basically it's building better and building to a higher standard. But the tragedy for me looking at it now is I'm seeing A-rated home, A2 is the minimum standard now. If you can do an A2 rated home, it's slightly cheaper to go to passive. And there's no reason other than learning a little bit, being a bit more ambitious, why we can't do it. And it's the first step. If you can get to passive, you can get to carbon zero very, very easily, really, really easily.
And you're pandemic proofing, you know, the ventilation standard in passive is an awful lot better. So you're going to have less risky indoor environments for people spreading disease.
I
was just going to agree because our first development was A2, and we're actually doing some post-occupancy research on the energy usage, and so we have sensors in all of the homes, and we're measuring things like temperature, relative humidity, and CO2. And I know Orla would be interested in this, and once when we have the figures, Orla, we'll share them with you. But just on some of the initial ones are really, really interesting, because what we're getting is very high peaks of CO2 at certain times, you know, and we think it's because we haven't gone for the full mechanical heat recovery ventilation system. We reckon if that was there, that would keep those peaks down. So like, there's not just the obvious benefits that Mel spoke about. There are these other benefits that you don't actually see unless you physically go and measure these things afterwards. sorry, that was just, yeah.
And that comes back to what you were saying, Orla, about using that flotilla model where smaller developers, as well as building to higher standards, the skills are to higher standards. They'll develop greater skills.
Yeah, and that brings costs down as well. I mean, people don't realize that. The reason costs, you know, tender prices were going up last year and the year before was because of a skills shortage, and the people who have the skills can charge more because they're not available. So, you know, evening out that peaks and troughs and booms and busts is huge benefits for, well, for employment, first off, that people aren't being sent off to Australia every 5 or 6 years when there's a downturn. But also it means we can hold the skills, because we've traditionally had poor building standards in this country because we keep doing that. We keep training people in a boom. The people who have skills are too busy to do things properly. And then we have a crash when nobody's available to do it and nobody gets trained up. So, you know, if we want to even that out and have sustainable jobs in construction, and there's a lot of people in construction who need them and in the regions, if we want to flatten that out, we want to get young people and more women into construction, there has to be better jobs there, you know, and keeping them in the kind of marginal economy where they're very susceptible to recession is not going to get us that sustainable industry.
And keeping those costs down will level out that curve. There's no more peak. You don't get the peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
You know, and this has been shown in other countries. Like, it's not rocket science at all. You build at almost the same rate through the peaks and through the troughs. You build up massive skills, and the demand is still there, and demand just goes on and on forever. And just to answer Martin's question about that million euros, Martin, or the billion euros, sorry, that's on how many houses could be built. If you were to do it all on affordable housing, an infinite number. Why? Because you're recirculating it all of the time. And you could be building all over the country and never lose one cent of that money. In fact, it would be earning money for you, because you can afford to build in a coupon in the cost of it. I guarantee you, if you give me that, I'll give you back $1.5 billion in 10 years' time, and we'll have built thousands of houses.
John Lyons, did you want to ask a question? And we just got a couple more. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Yeah, no, thanks, Tony, and to yourself and Martin and to all the panelists. Great discussion, very good information. I having spoken briefly to a couple of the panelists before on the issue of Devonhy Gardens, we have a similar vote coming up on the Oscar Traynor Road site. It's actually been pushed from November 2nd to November 16th, where some of us, we're going to set up a campaign to try stop that vote from going through with Section 183 to transfer the title deeds of the land, 17 hectares of land, to Glenveagh Properties. And I've made a lot of the points that have been made tonight to some of the officials, and I wish I had some of the optimism order that you have, but they look at you as if you've got, I don't know, 10 heads on your shoulders. They stare blankly at you as if to say, well, look, you know, do it ourselves, parcel it in the smaller pieces of land, get, you know, smaller operators on and all of this. You make all these points to them and they just stare blankly, because they are wedded, unfortunately, to the idea that it has to be big developers at scale. They take on all the financial risk. We don't take on any. And they see these deals as good deals. Even yesterday at a briefing, they talked about how the department wouldn't fund what they're getting with this deal with the developers. So the non-residential aspect of it, the community facilities, the parks, they're saying that the department wouldn't fund the city council to provide them in the development. So it's always a battle to try to try win them over to the idea that the city council, the local authorities, could do it better and more cheaply and more efficiently. But look, I have to say, all three, you, Mel and Orly, you are great, because you put out that information that we need. Because many of the city councillors, you know, we don't have, you know, easy access to a lot of this information. So it's very good to have. But we are, I think the only way we're going to try really deliver social and affordable is by, you know, issue by issue, trying to fight back and to make the cogent arguments and to try win over as many people as we can. And the next opportunity for that is on November the 16th, where hopefully we can stop that proposal going through. The threat will be, Tony, as you know, it was the same with Devonhy Gardens, when Brendan Kenny said that if you don't vote to give Barcher Capital the title deeds, there won't be any development on that site for the next 10 years. That's the threat that hangs over us, unfortunately. And it's a hard one for some councillors, because we are in a housing crisis. There's a lot of people suffering. And when that's the threat, that, you know, nothing's going to happen on this side, many councillors did take the option of going, well, look, something is better than nothing. So it's a battle, you know.
Yeah, I John, I get that. And let's tell the truth here. There are other councillors in the audience, and I hope they're listening, because they'll understand that the letters did come in. There was letters from the Minister for Housing that were more or less saying, you know, this is the deal, this is what's mm-hmm. happening. And it was kind of heavy handed in the end. But, you know, we're still looking at if we're looking at it, and you want to think about it in just a financial sense. I mean, Mel broke it down quite well. Hugh breaks it down. You know, and Orla knows all about procurement. We can do it cheaper. We can do it more efficiently. And I suppose the main argument here is we're talking about still in this stupid mindset where we're allowing ourselves to say how many of these houses will be affordable. What are you saying? By definition, you're saying the majority of everything else is unaffordable. Like, I mean, why are we just accepting that this entire site is going to be made up predominantly of unaffordable housing and then a few bits that we'll have to subsidize? It just seems madness. We need to set our bar higher. And I think people need to step up and actually understand that we can be more ambitious than 10% or a community center or some retail units. Sorry, Orla, go ahead.
Yeah, just to add to that, Tony, I mean, when you're saying most of it's unaffordable, what that actually means is if prices don't stay high in Dublin and you're relying on 60% or 75% of the development selling at very expensive prices, and the market in Dublin shifts, you know, which is out of the control of everybody, none of that development might happen. I mean, this is what happened the last time around with the public-private partnerships. You know, if it's a market solution and the market shifts with interest rates or international recession or pandemic or any other kind of crisis that we no idea is coming, it might mean that nothing happens on that site. Now, if you're doing Hugh's model, it doesn't really matter if there's a recession or not, because it's pitched below what private housing is. So there's always a market for it. But if you're trying to sell hundreds of units somewhere at 400, 450 and more thousand each, there's a very limited market. So what you'll get is a trickle feeding or halting completely. If the market conditions aren't right.
John, I think it's fair to say that when you're paid not to see, it's really difficult to see. I think that applies to a lot of what's going on at the moment. I agree with Orla. I'm very hopeful after listening to everybody on this evening. I am, because the obstacles are actually quite small. They are. It's how do we get past the mindset, and how do we get past the administration? And it's really horrible to think that that's the way we have to look at it. How do we get past it? But I come away from this feeling hopeful. I think it's very encouraging. And thank you all for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Just to say, Ian, I tried to add you. It's telling me I can't. Anne-Marie Quilligan, you made a brilliant point about the report of showing that homeowners are 44 times more better off than your renters. And look, that's where the system is. I do think we need to push back, and we need to set the bar a lot higher. Let's not talk about in terms of what percentage of these are affordable. It just seems madness. Mel Reynolds, Orla Hegarty, you, Brendan, thank you so much for your time, folks. We're just going to leave it there. And apologies for the crash in the middle. I don't know what happened there. But look, we'll have this out. And if you're feeling generous and you think it's great, go to tortoiseshack.ie/run2020. And click on the donate button. All the proceeds are going to Anna Liffey and Inner City Helping Homeless. So I'm going to complete my marathon on Sunday. It'll be 2,020 miles run in 2020. Look, you know, whatever you can throw in, it'll be terrific. Thanks very much.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony.